Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is February 23rd. We are in Sefer Daniel. And last time we read the entire Perek Zayin, Chapter 7. And we said that this time we would go through some of the themes and some of the details of it and get what we can out of it, at least in this setting. So what I want to do now is review basic theme of what the storyline of what we read, and then talk about some of the details. So Daniel here is talking about a dream that he had in the first year of Belshazzar's reign. That means Babel was still the ruling kingdom. And he has a dream that was a terrifying dream that he sees the ocean and the four winds of the world converge in one place on the ocean. And out of the ocean arise four chayos, four beasts. And he goes on to describe each of the beasts. The first is a lion, and it has wings of an eagle. And he sees that the wings get cut off, and the lion is forced to go down on its feet. And then it's like a human being that has to walk around, and also it gets the heart of a human being, which means it loses the strength of a lion. It becomes like a regular human being. Then he sees a second beast, which appears like a bear, and it stands to one side for a moment, and then it has three bones in its mouth between its teeth, and they say, there's a voice that calls out and says, get up and consume meat, much meat. After that comes a third beast, which appears like a leopard, and it has four wings, like a bird, on its back, and it has four heads, and it's given power. And then comes a beast, which is the most frightening of them all. And this one, Daniel does not compare it to any particular animal. And it's got all kinds of frightening parts to it. It's got teeth of iron. It eats and it grinds and it tramples what it leaves over. And it's got 10 horns. One of the horns, then an 11th horn appears, and three of the horns fall out. And that 11th horn, which is a small horn, also speaks in a very haughty way. And then Daniel says, I was watching as I saw the Elder of Days come, and chairs are placed. He sits, and Daniel describes a river of fire that comes forth from this Elder of Days, and angels are coming out of this river of fire, and he sees that because of the haughtiness of that little horn, that this last beast is killed and totally destroyed and burned up. And then he sees that the other beasts are given a little bit more time to live, and then he sees that then a man comes down from heaven, and to him is given majesty, power, the kingdom, and all the nations of the world bow down to this man and pay homage to him. Then Daniel says that I was frightened from this whole dream, and I went to one of the angels to ask, what is the dream all about? And he's told that these four beasts represent the four kingdoms that will enslave the Jewish people. They will become the powers, the ruling powers of the world. And then finally, at the end of days, the Jewish people will become the ruling power of the world. And then Daniel says, I wanted to know more about this fourth beast. And so he's given a little bit more details about the fourth beast with that one extra horn. And he says that I saw this beast fight with the Jewish people. The Jewish people are called the Ilin Kadishin, Kadish El Yonin, the holy ones, the upper holy ones, but that he fights with them, with the Jews, and beats them. And that fourth beast will take complete control of the world, and it will go on for a very long time, but eventually the kingdom will be given back to the Jewish people, and they will rule forever. Daniel says, this was the end of my dream, and he says he was very frightened by it, his face turned colors, and he kept the dream inside. He remembered it. He did not share it. He kept it inside. That was a synopsis of what we read last time in Perek Zayin. Now, it's obvious that there is a theme of the number four with the four beasts. And even one of the beasts, the third one, has four heads. It has four wings. And we know that there are Dalet Malchios. There are four kingdoms that enslave us. And the truth is that the number four is a recurring theme throughout the Torah and throughout the Gemara and really throughout all literature that is, all Torah literature. So it's tempting to try to line up the various fours and say that this one reflects this one, which reflects this one, which reflects this one, etc., etc., etc. It's tempting to do that. I am reluctant to do that because there are various interpretations, and what we have here in front of us is far more depth, has far more depth than we're going to be able to understand. It has far more depth than I personally understand, and certainly far more depth than we're able to discuss in a short class as we have today, tonight. So what I'd like to do rather than that is to paint a picture of what this theme of number four is. It will have to do with the first perek, the first chapter of Yechezkel, for those who remember that first chapter. But those who are not here for that, we'll review that part, whatever has to be reviewed. But there's a lot more that has to do with the number four. The number four is a major theme of the Pesach Seder, and that's also not by accident. Now, let's begin, rather than beginning at the beginning, which is with Bereishis, let's begin with Yechezkel. Because, ironically, with the first parak of Yechezkel, the first chapter of Yechezkel, where Yechezkel sees what? What's the first vision he sees?
The Merkava.
He sees the chariot of Hashem. Now, the chariot of Hashem, Rashi explains over there, is really Hashem's throne. We know that Hashem has a throne, even though he has no body and he doesn't sit. But there is a heavenly throne. There is a kisei hakavod. There's a chair of honor that is in Shamayim. Whatever that means, it is a spiritual item. We don't know what that means, but there's something, some sort of a throne. When that throne is in transit, it becomes a chariot. A chariot is something which is movable. It's in transit. And we know that Yechezkel saw a chariot, as we explained then, because Yechezkel was seeing the throne moving. And it was moving because it reflected Golus. It reflected exile. The Jews going into exile, which is preceded by Hashem's Shechina, Hashem's presence, leaving the Beis HaMikdash, leaving the temple. As we mentioned then, the Beis HaMikdash could not have been destroyed. The physical structure of the Beis HaMikdash could not have been destroyed, it could not have been burned, it could not have been smashed, had the Shechina, had Hashem's Divine Presence remained there. It was only with Hashem's Divine Presence leaving that then the empty shell of the eighth simba avanim, of the wood and stones that was the Beis HaMikdash, could then be destroyed. And that's the chariot, it's Hashem's throne moving away. Of course, whatever description we give of Hashem in these contexts can't be His true essence, and it can't be 100% real, because Hashem, where is He going to go when He moves away? Hashem, as we say, Hashem is the makom, He's the place. The world, you can't say Hashem is in a particular place. Hashem is greater than, bigger than, larger than any place. You can't say He's in a place. That limits Hashem. And you can't limit Hashem in any way. And therefore, when we talk about Hashem moving, it is some sort of expression to make us understand in human terms what is happening. But somehow, the Shekhinah, Hashem's divine presence, is moving, and He sees a chariot that is moving. The chariot is made up of four, what?
Faces.
Well, there are four faces on each of these four things. What is it made up of? Four? It's four angels. Those angels are called, who remembers? Chayos. Chayos, which means beasts. In fact, it's the exact same word used to describe the beasts here in Parag Zion. If you look, of course, here it's in Aramaic, and over there it's in Hebrew. But if you look in the beginning of Parag Zion, beginning of the seventh chapter, if you look in Pasuk Gimel, verse 3, the Pasuk says, V'arba chevon ravravon, four large beasts. The word chevon is the same word as chayos in Aramaic, in Aramis. In fact, Rashi, on those words, V'arba chevon, says, V'dalad chayos, and four beasts. The word chaya means an animal or a beast. Now we know chaya can be a woman's name. It's not necessarily a negative word. In fact, when it's used to describe the angels that are Hashem's chariot, they obviously don't mean it's not a negative term. There it's a positive term. And we know that in Parsha Shmos, as we've been learning on Sunday evenings, we know that in Parsha Shmos, that Shifra and Puah respond to Paro when he says, how come the Jewish boys are still alive after I told you to kill them? And they say, because the Jewish women are kichayos heina. They are like the beasts of the field. They give birth without a midwife. There it's not used as a negative term. It's used as a positive term. The word chaya can be used negatively. It can be used positively. We see that the four beasts of Daniel's dream, of Daniel's vision, which represent the four kingdoms that enslaved the Jewish people, and there it's used as a negative term, we see the same phrase being used by Yechezkel, the four chayos, referring to angels, awesome angels, that represent the chariot of Hashem. So that is not coincidental, that it's the same word. It seems that the four angels of Yechezkel's dream, Yechezkel's vision, I should say, and the four beasts of Daniel's dream are two sides of the same coin. It's not coincidental at all. Now, it would be very nice if the beasts of Daniel's dream would align themselves with the four faces of Yechezkel's chariot. When he says that he sees four chayos, and they each have a specific face, each one had all four faces, but one represented one of the four faces more than the other three. And the four faces over there, it would have been nice to line them up perfectly with over here. But unfortunately, only one lines up. Not the bear.
Eagle.
Not the eagle. No, well, okay, the eagle does, but here there is no eagle.
Lion.
It's a lion with eagle's wings. Over there, there was a lion. What else?
Eagle.
An eagle.
You had a man.
A man.
And a jackal.
And what?
Ox.
And an ox. And that ox later was transformed into a kruv, into a cherub.
Into a what?
A cherub.
Cherub.
It went from an ox into a chariot. We explained then in Sefer Yechezkel that because the Jews sinned with the golden calf, and an ox would conjure up the image of the golden calf, Hashem in His mercy changed it to a kruv, to a cherub. So it would have been nice to line them all up perfectly, but obviously it won't line up so perfectly because only one, and that is the lion, is exactly the same in both visions. Where the one that Yechezkel sees is a lion of grandeur, a lion that represents strength and the awesomeness of the angel that represents Hashur, that is Hashem's agent. Here it's a lion that is a fearsome lion that is here to destroy and to enslave. But they're both lions. The other three, though, don't line up perfectly. Because the four over here, after the lion with the eagle's wings, you have a bear, a leopard, and an unnamed beast. Over there, you have an eagle, an ox, and a person, a man. So they don't line up perfectly. We could spend time trying to line them up perfectly. I would rather not do that. I'd rather move into the broader theme of the number four and show what it is representing, show what is happening with this number four. What is the first theme of four that we find explicitly in the Torah? It's not necessarily the first in creation, but the first explicit mention of number four that we have in the Torah, other than the fourth day of creation, because the fourth day is one of is number four out of seven. I want to know where we have a finite four, the first time in the Torah.
We have the four kings and the five kings.
That's good, but there's one before that.
The Avos.
The Avos, it's three.
Three, I'm sorry. Imos.
There are four, but they come after the four kings and five kings. All the way back in Parshas Bereishis, there already is a mention of four.
You've got the rivers.
Excellent. The rivers are the first mention of four that you have in the Torah. It says that there was a v'nahar yotzei me'eden l'hashkosas ha'gan. There was a river that came out of Eden to water the gan, to water the Garden of Eden. Came out of Eden to go into the garden and water it. U'misham yipared. From there it separated. V'haya l'arba'a rashim. And it became four heads. Four heads. The river became four heads. One of the beasts here has four heads. It's also not coincidental. It splits into four rivers. Which four rivers are they? Well, the four rivers, the Torah gives them names. Pishon, Gihon, Chidekel, and Piras. Pishon is the Nile River. That's one of the rivers. Rashi says so. Gihon, Rashi doesn't say which river it is, but there are those who speculate about it. Chidekel and Piras are the Euphrates and the Tigris. Some want to say that the second river, Gihon, is the, and Pishon, which is the Nile, that one is the White Nile, one is the Blue Nile. At the upstream of the Nile, which is south from Egypt, which is upstream of the Nile, where it begins, it really starts as two rivers. One is called the Blue Nile, one is called the White Nile. The White Nile has a lot of rapids, which is why it's called the White Nile. And then they come together and form the larger Nile River, which runs south to north through Egypt. Some would argue that Gihon, which Rashi says is a very raging river, is the White Nile. That's what some would argue. Be that as it may, you have these four rivers, and that's the first time you find the number four. The Mefarshim tell us, the commentaries say, that when Hashem created the world, He created it with four basic elements. And the word element here is not being used the same way that it's used scientifically, but that there are four basic elements that Hashem used to create the world. And they are the most basic parts of the world.
Water,
earth,
fire,
and
wind.
And air, right, the wind, right. Those are the four. And that each one has a different characteristic from the other, and everything has some aspect of those four things in it. We know that in creation, Hashem created four orders, from lowest to highest. Four orders. And we've mentioned these before. We have domain. Domain means that which is What's that?
Inanimate.
Or dormant.
Yeah.
That would be like stone and sand and dirt, things of that nature. Those are, or metals, those are domain. They are, domain literally means quiet. Mm-hmm. Silent. Then comes someach, which means that which grows, which includes all vegetation, all plant life. Then comes chai. Chai means living, which means animated, moving, which would be all the animals, all the birds, all the fish, all the insects. All that is chai. And then Hashem created medaber, that which speaks, which is the human being. Four levels of creation. Again, the theme of number four. Four elements in creation, four levels of creation. Four rivers that are basic to creation. We move in the Chumash and we find the war between the four kings and the five kings. And who wins that war? The four kings win that war. Those four kings, it's not by accident that there are four kings. And there you find the theme of number four. Of course, in the Pesach Seder, when we list all the numbers in Nirtza, we start with Echad Miyodea, who knows one, and we get to who knows four. What is four? The Imahos, our matriarchs, are four. So whatever it is that the number four represents, the matriarchs, not the patriarchs, not the fathers, but the mothers, somehow reflect that theme of four. When what Daniel is seeing over here is that when the Jews are not doing what we're supposed to do, then the kingdom of the world, we'll call it the dominion, which is a good word, somebody had that in translation, the dominion of the world passes from the Jewish people to the hands of another kingdom. And when it goes into that kingdom, the Jews become subservient to that kingdom. And the first one it passes to is Babel, Babylonia. It goes from there, which is represented by the lion with the eagle's wings, it goes on to Persia, which is represented by the bear. From there it moves on to the Greeks, which is represented by the leopard. And from there it moves on to the Romans, which is this fearsome unnamed beast. And then it goes to Mashiach. And Mashiach is a descendant of David HaMelech, King David. And the dominion of the world goes back into the hands of the Jewish people. The default is that the world should be ruled by the Jewish people. The dominion of the world. That's the default. What does that mean? Of course, it doesn't mean that we should be controlling everybody. That's not the point. The point is that we represent Hashem, and Hashem's dominion should be over the entire world. So if we have that seat of dominion, then Hashem does, because we represent Hashem. And that is the default. That's what should be. When averos are done, then unfortunately it chips away at that dominion, and galus, exile, is necessary. And the dominion passes into the hands of these other kingdoms. But it passes into the hands of four kingdoms. The Arba Malchios, the four kingdoms. That phrase, Dalid Malchios, the four kingdoms, you will find that throughout Torah literature. Doesn't matter where you go and what you look at, you will find references to Dalid Malchios, the four kingdoms. It seems that when Hashem decreed that there would be Golos, there would be exile, there was going to be Tzegezunt, there was going to be four kingdoms, no fewer and no more than four Golios, four Malchios, four kingdoms that would temporarily I mean from a historical perspective, temporarily have the dominion of the world. So where it should be the Jews, it passes into 1, 2, 3, 4, then back to the Jews. In terms of how much time it goes on for, that's not necessarily known. As we are in the fourth Golos right now, we don't know when it's going to end. But the time is not really relevant. There has to be four. Why does it have to be four? What is the purpose of these four? And if these four are meant to be mirror images or the other side of the coin of the four chayos, the four angels that represent Hashem's chariot or Hashem's throne, then how do we understand that? What is this significance of four? It seems that when this doesn't seem, this is clear, and then we'll say what it seems. When Hashem created the world, we know, going back to the basics of Hashem's creation of the world and what we are doing here, we know that the purpose of creation and the purpose of us being here is for the world to perfect itself and to come close to Hashem, which is really saying the same thing. That Hashem created a place where one could have free will, where one is not coerced to serve Hashem, where we can choose to or not to, and the goal is to choose to serve Hashem, and when we do so, we perfect ourselves individually, and we perfect the entire universe. And through that, everything comes close to Hashem. Why did Hashem want that? So that already is a whole other discussion, which we've talked about before, that ultimately Hashem wants to be meitiv, He wants to give good, and it's impossible to do that in its most profound way without this testing ground, so to speak. But let's not take it that far. Let's just deal with perfecting the universe, getting close to Hashem. The universe is comprised of four basic elements, as we mentioned before. There are four basic elements. That is what Hashem used for the entire universe, which means that everything in the universe can be broken down to four basic parts. People can be broken down to four basic parts. The planets can be broken down to four basic parts. Animals can. Every part of the physical universe can be broken down into these four basic parts of fire, wind, water, and ground. Right. When we are perfecting the universe, that means perfecting everything about it. It means every part of it is meant to be perfected and brought close to Hashem. Now, if Hashem made four basic physical elements, they must necessarily reflect four basic spiritual elements. The spiritual realm and the physical realm, remember, the spiritual realm is just as real, if not more real, than the physical realm. We only sense physicality as being real, and we sense spirituality as being somewhat a word which doesn't really mean anything, ethereal. Some type of which we don't really sense it in a strong way. But we know that the spiritual realm exists, and exists it exists in a very real way, more real than the physical world. Everything in the physical world reflects the spiritual world. Everything in the spiritual world reflects the physical world. We talked about this extensively in the first chapter of Yechezkel. The four basic elements of the spiritual world are represented by those four chayos, those four angels that are Hashem's chariot. More than that, we know that there are four attending angels, four malachim. We even give them names. What are their names?
Gabriel.
Raphael.
Michael.
And? We said Raphael. Oriel. Okay, we say, Mi, Michael. On my right is Michael. Mi smoli, Gabriel. My left is Gabriel. Ome alfanai, Oriel. In front of me is Oriel. Ome acharai, Raphael. Behind me is Raphael. That's also not coincidental. Those four angels also represent the four basic spiritual elements. And if one tried to, one could align the four physical elements with the four spiritual elements. Again, that's beyond the scope of tonight's class. But this is, all these things can be aligned. You can align the rivers with all these things. You can align the imahos, the four matriarchs, with these four basic elements. Which, as I said, we're not going to do that this evening, but they all are representative of the four basic building blocks that Hashem put into every part of creation. Yes?
The four names for our spiritualist, you know, whether it be Neshama, did that also come?
Very likely. I didn't think of that. Very likely. Well, I think there are five. Okay, very likely, but I'm not sure. Good. When we have the Pesach Seder, and the theme of four is so evident in the Pesach Seder, starting with the Arba Lashonos Shel Geula. You know, you said you wanted a Pesach class. The four Lashonos Shel Geula, the four languages, the four words that Hashem uses for redemption. V'hutzeisi, v'hitzalti, v'go'alti, v'lokachti. V'hutzeisi, I will take out. V'hitzalti, I will save. V'go'alti, I will redeem. V'lokachti, I will take. Those four are also representative of the four basic building blocks. Hashem is saying, I'm going to take you fully. Every part of whatever the building block is, whatever these four languages represent, I'm taking you completely to be mine. We drink four cups of wine, each one representing one of those four words of Geula, of redemption. And the four cups represent that. That's also not coincidental. There are four sons that we address at the Pesach Seder. Every person, every single person in the world fits in to one of those four basic categories of sons that we are, it's not really sons, it's children, that we are addressing. The Chacham Rasha Tam and Sheino de Alishal that we address at the Seder is the four basic types. There's wide variations amongst the types, but there's four types that a person that fits into, one or the other. And they also represent this totality. There's a totality of children that is represented by these four children. There's a totality of relationship that is represented by the four languages that Hashem uses when He redeems us. And there's a totality of gratitude, which is represented by the four cups of wine, and we thank Hashem for having done everything that He did. This is all one theme with many parts to it. But now we got to take it to a higher level. Yeah.
Well, each child, though, could represent all four of those.
Everybody represents, in some way, all four. But one is going to be more blatant than the other three. Mm-hmm. The matriarchs as well. It's not that Sarah only represents one. Sarah has all four in her, but one is going to be more blatant than the other three. As with Rivka, Rachel.
Dominant.
That's right.
Over the other.
That's right.
And each one
embedded in Klal Yisrael, each one, a matriarch means that she's the mother of the nation. She created the nation. Each one embedded in the nation another one of these building blocks. Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. Each one contributed another one of these basic elements. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Brachos that there are three mishmaros. There are three... No. There are three shifts in the evening, at night. Three shifts, meaning of guards. When you have guards that guard something overnight, there are three shifts. Now, what does the Gemara mean? I mean, if you have something that needs to be guarded at night, you hire a night watchman, you hire as many as you want, and you have as many shifts as you choose to make. But the Gemara is saying that within the nighttime, Hashem created three shifts, each one 4 hours long in a 12-hour night. And these four mishmaros, three mishmaros, three shifts, these three guardings, the Gemara says have each one has a siman. Each one has a sign that if you don't have a watch, because in those days they didn't have watches, and you couldn't use the sun as your timepiece in the middle of the night. So how did you know when one shift started and one shift ended?
By the moon.
So you could if there's a moon, but there isn't always a moon.
Right.
So how do you know? So the Gemara says there are signs that Hashem also embedded into the natural order. During the first shift, the Gemara says, then the chamorim, a chamor, a donkey's bray, during that first shift. Now, I'm not a farmer, can't tell you what donkeys do, but evidently donkeys tend to make noise in the first third of the night. During the second shift, the dogs cry out. Klavim tzalakim, the Gemara says. And during the third shift, the Gemara says, Isha misaperasim baila, a woman converses with her husband, and tinok yonik mishadei imo, and a baby will nurse from its mother during that last shift of the night. We are so far from being attuned to this because we don't run our lives based on sunrise and sunset. We run our lives based on an artificial thing called a clock. That's an artificial way of telling time. But the true measure of time is the natural order of sunrise and sunset. And if we ran our lives that way, we would be much more attuned to these things. The Maharal writes that these three, since Lila, nighttime, is akin to, which is darkness, is akin to galus, to exile, these three signs represent the first three galuyos, the first three exiles. He writes that the first one is the chamor, is the donkey. And the donkey, that represents subservience. A donkey is a beast of burden. It's something that a person owns for no other purpose than to do his work, to carry things for him. You don't own a donkey for companionship. You don't own a donkey to guard the house at night. You don't own a donkey even to give you milk or wool. That's not the purpose of a donkey. It doesn't even provide you with meat. The purpose of a donkey is to be a beast of burden. Says the Maharal, that represents an exile where the Jews are enslaved as, so to speak, beasts of burden, where we are expected to work for that nation that has dominion over us. He writes that's the first exile, which is Babel, which is Babylonia, where the Jews were primarily enslaved. The second sign is the dogs crying out, barking. Says the Maharal, that represents death, as the death. As we know, when the Jews left Egypt, L'chol b'nei Yisrael lo yecharatz kelev l'shono, that the dog did not bark, but that was miraculous. That normally a dog would bark or howl when there is death. And the second gullus, which is that of the Persians, they attempted to and nearly eradicated all the Jews. And that is the Purim story which you wanted to hear about tonight. See, we bring it all together. The third is the woman talking to her husband and the baby nursing from its mother. Says the Maharal, that represents a gullus, an exile, which is more friendly, which attempts to draw us into its culture without a heavy hand. And the Greeks, with the Hellenization of the Jews, and the Hellenists, the Misyavnim, who were Jews who became Greek, that is the third exile. That's not to say there wasn't some element there of a heavy hand, which came later with the Hanukkah story, which is how we got out of that gullus, but the main thrust of that gullus, of that exile, was not one of enslaving the Jews or threatening the Jews with death. Rather, it was one of enticing the Jews into a foreign culture. That's three. But what about the fourth? What about the theme of number four? Says the Maharal, and this is something which I've heard many times, I heard this for the first time in my early years in high school in yeshiva, the fourth exile, which is Edom, which is Rome, it encompasses the previous three. They are all subsumed by the fourth one. The fourth one is so large, so fearsome, that it encompasses elements of all the other three. And it's the entirety of the night. That's also why it goes on for such a long period of time. This fourth beast is not given a name. It's not. We don't hear that it's a lion. We don't hear that it's a leopard. We don't hear that it's a bear. Because it encompasses them all. It's a nameless beast because every type of animal is represented by this beast. This beast is, it's the totality of the other three in the one beast. This is Galus Edom that we endure now, which is why in Edom, which has gone on for such a long period of time, we Jews have been subjected to all three of the previous types of exiles. We have certainly been enslaved. We have certainly been threatened with and actually killed. And now we are experiencing the third type, which is the enticing, the assimilation, which comes along with the overt friendliness of the nation that we are enslaved by. This is the fourth Golus. I just want to say as an aside, the Maharal does mention that there are those who would like to suggest that the fourth exile is Yishmael, because the Arabs, because they're also a very large nation, and they also have dominion over the Jewish people. But he writes emphatically that that is a mistake. That it's clear from Chazal, it's clear from our sages, that it is Edom, which would be represented by Western man or the Christian world, that is the fourth exile. It's sometimes hard to remember that in our day and age, where we have more trouble with the Arab world than we do with the Christian world, by and large. But it's not so long ago that the Christian world certainly was the most terrible that we've ever endured. You know, all you need to do is go back to the Holocaust. One has to be careful not to become focused on one small time frame in history. History is much larger than that, and we have to keep the bigger picture in mind. It could be that Yishmael is incorporated into Edom. As we've mentioned before, after all, Edom, who is Esav, was a son-in-law of Yishmael. So there is an unholy alliance between the two. So there is that, which could be that. Or it could be that it's some sort of a sideshow, but not the main event. Whatever it is, the Maharal makes it clear that in his opinion it is a mistake to believe that Yishmael is the fourth exile. It is clearly Edom. Now, really, there's a much more basic theme of four, which is mentioned in Daniel's vision, which we haven't talked about. And that is, there are four directions. There is north, east, south, and west. And Daniel says, the four winds came from the four directions of the world and converged on that place in the ocean. And that's where the beasts came from. That's also not coincidental. That also represents the four building blocks of creation. Just a moment. Within the Jewish people, as we know, we are given four camps, four places where the 12 tribes are divided into four camps, four degolim, four flags, where the Jews encamped in the Midbar, north, south, east, and west. And they're also going to represent the different building blocks and the different goluyos, the different exiles, and the different angels. All of this is going to be one thing. The Maharal writes that where do the Jews fit in? You've got four. Where do the Jews fit in?
The middle.
the Jews are in the middle. As we've always mentioned, we are the center stage of history. The Nekuda, the point, the midpoint of the four is the Jewish people. We are the fifth, or if you want to put it differently, we are above the four. We are beyond the four, or we bring together the four. Ultimately, what is supposed to happen is that the four revolve around the one. That we representing Hashem, lift everybody else up and carry them along with us to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what is supposed to happen. Unfortunately, we have not kept to what we should have done. When that happens, then there is an aberration. The dominion of the world should be at that midpoint, at that central point, which is the Jewish people. That should be the dominion that rises above the four directions and pulls them up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what should happen. When we don't do the right thing, the dominion shifts to one part or the other. And there's an imbalance. Picture one of these, I don't want to say like a top or a dreidel, but think of one of these things which has four parts sticking out of it and a midpoint, and if you, and it's perfectly balanced, and then if you put too much weight or any weight on any one of the four, the thing topples to the side. That's an imbalance. It is an aberration from what should be. When Bavel became the dominant force in the world, the universe had an imbalance and shifted. There was an imbalance where the dominant force was. The dominant force moved on to Persia, then moved on to the Greeks, then moved on to the Romans, moving around the four parts. Eventually, it will shift back to the middle, and there'll be a perfect balance, and then we'll be moved up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When these four nations have dominion, they masquerade, another Purim word, they masquerade as being representatives of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They masquerade as being the truth, as being what the world is all about. The one who did the best job of actually being somewhat close to what the dominion of HaKadosh Baruch Hu should look like was Nebuchadnezzar. As we talked about, who was a Russia, he was evil. But we talked about how Hashem gave him so much power, it was almost superhuman what he had. That he was able to even give orders to the animals and they'd have to listen. That was, imagine the sense that the Jews had. Here the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and all of a sudden now they have this king who can do supernatural things. It's almost like Hashem really did shift the center stage to Nebuchadnezzar. And that he really is supposed to be where he is. It was frightening. Nebuchadnezzar had that grandeur that represented dominion over the whole world. He was the closest non-Jewish dominion that seemed to represent the truth. But he wasn't the most powerful. Really the most powerful is the one we're in now, is Edom. Because Edom, although he doesn't have the supernatural power of Nebuchadnezzar, but Edom's dominion is so powerful that it's no longer a question of appearing like Edom represents Hashem. Rather, it's almost like Edom negates the need for Hashem. There is no Hashem. Hashem doesn't exist. Kochi va'otzem yadi, it's my strength, it's my power. It's human beings that are the be-all and end-all of everything. It's a complete aberration from what should be. And it's a total darkness. It takes over everything. And everything is consumed by this Edom darkness.
Is that what it says here, the haughtiness?
That's the haughtiness, that's the fearsomeness of the beast. All of this is what is being represented here in this vision that Daniel has. Eventually, everything will shift back to us. What is happening here, though, is that since we are not perfecting the four basic elements of the physical world, which are connected to the four basic elements of the spiritual world, then one or the other becomes dominant. And they begin to resemble the be-all and end-all of the world. But in the end, what has to happen is it shifts back to us, and again, we elevate everything else. As the midpoint, we elevate everything else up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is what ultimately has to happen. Yeah.
In Genesis it says that when God's presence is, Hashem's presence is felt, then a wind comes from the east. A wind comes up from the east, and that is an indicator that Hashem's presence is near. So
it's not. I'm not sure which verse you're referring to.
I don't know which verse.
It says it in a few places that there's different winds. It's not only the east.
No, there's also the west.
Really, they're all mentioned at some point or other.
Right. But when Hashem moves away, then the wind comes from the west.
Again, I think you'd have to give a more specific example.
I know. Well, I'd have to look it up. But one question is, the four beasts, would they be brought in on the winds coming from each direction?
Apparently. I mean, they came out of the ocean. But the winds represent them. When they blew, they represented those four.
Because the wind would stir up the...
Yeah, that's what happens in Daniel's vision. Mm-hmm. That's what happens in Daniel's vision. Yeah.
I just have a question with all the four directions and the four everything. It's interesting that when we bench Lulav, we do six.
Okay. Because really there are six directions. Really there are four, and then there's up and down. That's true. However, up and down are meant to represent something otherworldly. HaKadosh Baruch Hu or whatever, it's meant to represent different. So it's true, you're right, that there really are six directions. But the four are the physical world.
You have the four parts
of the Arabinim, the four parts of the world. That's true.
Yeah,
also.
But that's true, we do six. If infinity is represented by a circle, then north, south, east, and west would be going everywhere.
Okay.
All places. Wouldn't it? I guess so.
So there is a lot more depth here, as you can tell. We're only scratching the surface. But what we are doing is we're showing that it's not coincidental that there are four kingdoms. It is not coincidental that there are four chayos. And the theme of four as the basic building blocks are constantly resurfaced in everything, in all Torah literature. If we are the fifth, if you say it that way, and some say it that way, some say that, for example, in the four types of creations, as we mentioned before, domain, Sameach, Chai, Medaber, those four, that there is a fifth, and the fifth is Yisrael. As we mentioned, the fifth is the midpoint, which are the Jewish people, which are meant to raise everything else up. In the Echad Mi Yodea, what is five? Who knows five? What is five? The five books of the Torah. Chamishei Chumshei Torah. And that's the ultimate unification of the world. That's ultimately what brings everything to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When we are acting with that five, when it is the five, the Chamishei Chumshei Torah, that we represent properly, then we occupy that midpoint, we have the dominion, and we bring everything up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It is when that fifth element is missing that one of the other four takes over. The four kings defeating the five kings do not represent Torah. But the four defeating the five is also meant in some way to show this struggle of four and five that there is in the world. So we have to leave it at this, and this is what we're going to get out of this right now. The other visions of Daniel, as we move along to Parakhes in chapter 8, are also going to be very cryptic, and there's going to be a lot to delve into. The one advantage we have when we're on to chapter 8 is we switch back into Hebrew, right, which will make it a little bit easier.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.